Good afternoon and welcome to this meeting of the Conservative Association. My name is Samantha Means and I will be co-chairing this meeting with Professor Lord Desai, who has kindly agreed to lead the questions. It is a great honour for us to present our guest speaker today. He was born and educated in Edinburgh and entered the legal profession, becoming an advocate and a member of the Queen's Council. He became the Member of Parliament for the Edinburgh Pentlands in 1974 and held his first ministerial portfolio in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in 1983. In 1986, he joined the Cabinet, first as Secretary of State for Scotland, then moved to the Department of Transport and later the Ministry of Defence, before returning to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office as Secretary of State last summer. Please welcome the Right Honourable Malcolm Rifkins MP.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, thank you very much indeed for that welcome. It is not my first visit to the LSE, and indeed, as I travel around the world, I am very conscious of the very special reputation that the London School of Economics continues to have. Last year, I was in South Africa, and I was having a discussion with one of the new South African ministers. He was a former, very senior member of the South African Communist Party during the liberation struggle, and he was also active member of the military wing of the ANC, Umkhonto Wesizwe, who had been involved in various terrorist incidents over several years. And in my discussions with them, I asked them whether during the years of struggle, whether they had had any training in Russia. And he said, oh yes, indeed. In fact, we went to Odessa and we got not only military training, but also ideological education. And the discussion then moved on, and he told me how at a later stage there had been a split within the ANC as to whether violence was an inevitable way of achieving change in South Africa, or whether it was possible, as some argued, to achieve change through peaceful means. And I asked him, which side did he take in this particular argument? And he said, oh, I was an unregenerate believer in the inevitability of violence. I remember arguing that the class struggle meant that violence was inevitable, that those who had power would never peacefully hand it over. And I said, is that what they taught you in Russia? And he said, no, that's what they taught me in the London School of Economics. I'm sure that was all a long time ago, and the world has moved on quite dramatically. I'm sure that Lord Desai couldn't possibly be associated with that kind of advice or educational approach. That's my working assumption. Can I, if I may, share with you for not too long some thoughts on the fundamental objectives of British foreign policy, and then I want to allow maximum time for questions in order that you can put your point to me and see if I can try and respond to them. But what I'd like to do is to look over the next few minutes at essentially three areas of our foreign policy, which I believe sum up our major priorities. Firstly, inevitably the question of the security, the independence of these islands is the first objective of our foreign policy as of our defense policy. And I want to say something about NATO and the changing face of Europe since the end of the Soviet Union. Secondly, I want to look at the economic and social transformation of Europe, and in particular, the relevance of the European Union. And thirdly, I want to comment on some of the global aspects of our foreign policy and attitudes towards the Third World and issues of that kind. And first of all, therefore, on questions of basic European security. And we are all privileged to be living in one of the most extraordinary periods of change, if one looks back over the last 10 years, more fundamental than any time since the French Revolution in 1789, because we have seen two fundamental changes. Not only the collapse of communism and the end of the Warsaw Pact and the end of the Cold War, that is a fundamental change, but coexisting with that, we have also seen the disintegration of Europe's last empire, the Russian Empire. And it's well worth remembering that Russian Empire didn't just begin in 1917. It goes back to Peter the Great and 300-400 years ago. And yet, at the same time as communism collapsed, the Soviet Union disintegrated into no less than 15 separate states. And that's changed the whole map of Europe. And so I believe at this stage, in the changing political scene in Europe, there is a lot of new thinking that has not yet been properly taken forward. Many of us are conscious of the extraordinary changes in the old Czechoslovakia and Poland and Hungary. Hundreds of thousands of people today visit Prague and visit Warsaw and Budapest and look forward to welcoming these new democracies, these new market economies, into the wider European scene of things. But what we perhaps have not given sufficient thought to is the comparable, in some respects even more dramatic, changes taking place to the east of Poland, and indeed outside Russia itself. There is a country, Ukraine, over 50 million people, an independent state for the first time for hundreds of years, in a strategic geopolitical position in the southern part of Europe, whose independence and integrity of its statehood will itself depend to determine the whole future of Russia and its relations with the rest of Europe. Because if Russia was ever able to reabsorb Ukraine and the Baltic states and these other states that have been created within the old Soviet Union, then you would see the reemergence of a Russian empire in a very fundamental sense, with a potential threat to the independence and integrity of other countries. If, on the other hand, we see countries like Ukraine, like the Baltic states, like the new states of Central Asia, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and so forth, if they all develop into healthy states with their own independence and integrity and with their own ability to control their own destiny, then we have a quite transformed European and Asian situation of a kind that will make a very major contribution to global stability. And therefore, one of the great challenges, not only for Britain, but also for NATO and for Western countries, is how we can contribute to that process of peaceful evolution and how we can adapt to this new map of Europe that has come into existence just in the last 5 or 6 years. One of the great debates is about whether NATO should enlarge. And I've no doubt that over the next few years, NATO will enlarge. There will be countries, there already are countries like Poland, like the Hungarians, like the Czechs, who are very anxious to join the alliance. And of course, there is no reason of principle why they should not do so. But I add one important fact, that we must not be obsessed by questions of the enlargement of NATO to the exclusion of the overall strategic and security issues, of which that is only part. A sensible policy for Britain and for NATO is to have a tripartite strategy. By tripartite, I mean as follows. First of all, in a serious and responsible way, to, over a period of time, negotiate with those countries that might wish to join NATO, those new democracies in Central and Eastern Europe. That is something which will happen. But coexisting with that, we must also develop a strategy for NATO's relations with Russia itself, because Russia remains a major nuclear power. It has something like 10,000 strategic nuclear warheads. It is a country whose contribution will be crucial to the battle against nuclear proliferation. It is an important power in its own right, entitled to expect friendly relations with Western Europe and to be treated with respect and dignity as an important contributor to the international community. So we have to develop a proper strategic relationship between NATO and Russia at the same time as we are developing a policy of enlarging NATO to incorporate those countries that might wish to join. But I said a tripartite strategy because we also need to have a serious relationship with countries like Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, the Ukraine, the Caucasus republics, the new republics of Central Asia, for the reasons that I mentioned a few moments ago. And only by such an overall approach can we see a prospect for a stable relationship evolving. Now, I believe that one of the most important developments of the last few months, of a positive kind, was the agreement reached between the Russians and NATO to serve together in Bosnia as part of the peace implementation force. And it's worth remembering that today Russians and NATO forces are working together effectively under the same chain of command, effectively carrying out the same tasks. And that has not happened at any time since the end of the Second World War, and would have been quite literally inconceivable a few short years ago, possibly a few short months ago. And what makes it particularly relevant is that while over the last few years there has been much welcome contact between ministers, between diplomats, at the cultural level, at the social level, between the new Russia and the countries of Western Europe, where there has been very little contact is between the military of Russia and of the West. I remember when I was defense minister going to Moscow about 3 years ago and seeing General Grachev, the Russian defense minister. And I asked him, up till the time of the end of the Cold War, how many officers from NATO countries had you ever met? And he said, none. And that was true not only in his case, but true of the vast majority of senior Russian or ex-Soviet military. And therefore, if we are to work for a stable Europe, it needs to have the relationship between the military of Russia and that of Western Europe. And the single best example of that happening in practice is what we are seeing in Bosnia. Because that enables President Yeltsin or others who wish to take forward the reform process in Russia to say NATO is not a threat. It is not just an occasion for ministers or politicians or civilians to meet. Here we are seeing practical cooperation between our own military and that of Western countries in Bosnia, and perhaps that will be a precedent in other areas as well. So I believe that as we are trying to concoct a structure of security in Europe, that is the framework within which we have to operate. Now, I mentioned that my next theme was going to be on European Union. And there is a link, you know, between the two, which we need to ponder about for just a moment. In Western Europe, we have all had a great and ongoing debate about the degree of integration that we believe appropriate in Western Europe or in Europe as a whole at this moment in time. And the European Union is seen, quite rightly, as the single most important way in which the countries of Europe are drawing closer together and, in some respects, acquiring supranational institutions. It's worth reflecting on the fact that as we debate year after year about the integration of Western Europe, the experience of Eastern Europe has not been integration but disintegration. And I don't just mean the old Soviet Union, though there, as I mentioned, it has collapsed into 15 separate countries. And then we've had Yugoslavia, a country which existed as a single state from 1919, 1920, now five separate countries. Czechoslovakia, splitting in two between the Czech Republic and Slovakia, although in a welcome, peaceful way. And so as Western Europe has drawn closer together and has achieved an unprecedented degree of integration and supranational institutions, the experience of the other half of our continent has been the opposite, has been disintegration of a very fundamental kind. In a sense, that is paralleled elsewhere in Western Europe as well by the various nationalist movements that have become much more active in recent years. The Basques and Catalans in Spain, the Welsh or Scottish nationalist movements in the United Kingdom, the movements in Belgium for Flemish and Walloon autonomy, and so forth. So it's not entirely an Eastern European phenomenon, but it is one which has quite profound political implications. And if we are envisaging a European Union, which one day is going to increase its membership to the East and become a truly European Union as opposed to a Western European Union, then that has profound implications for the way in which the European Union operates. Because when it was first created, way back in the 1950s, it was a European Union of six countries. Now it is a European Union of 15 countries. Already we are committed to entering into negotiations about possible enlargement with Cyprus, with Malta, possibly with the Hungarians, the Poles, the Czechs, and one day with the Baltic states, Romanians, Bulgarians, and so forth. And if we are having to contemplate, as we are, a European Union which may expand from 15 to 25 or even 30 countries in the next 15 or 20 years, then that has very substantial implications, both for the workings of the institutions of the European Union. How will the Commission operate? Will each country have its own commissioner? It would be absurd to expand the commission simply because of the number of countries. What will be the implications for the Council of Ministers? What are the consequences for voting, for agreements that may be required? How will the European Parliament react to changes of this kind? And most important of all, what degree of actual political and economic integration is either feasible or desirable if one is contemplating a European Union of 30 states? As opposed to a neat core of five or six, as it was when the Union first began. Now, the United Kingdom is often portrayed, for understandable reasons, as a difficult partner on European Union issues. I'm choosing my words carefully since I came back to the Foreign Office. In some respects, we are a difficult partner. I don't think that's bloody-mindedness on the part of the current government. I think the reality is that British governments ultimately will have to reflect British interests and British perceptions of their national interests and their national requirements. And the fact that we're an island, the fact of our geographical position, the fact of the deep roots that our own Westminster system has had over many centuries, plus the absence of a tradition of integration, which has existed in some parts of the continent even before the European Union came into existence, are all factors that lead towards this British reserve in regard to a number of areas of policy. But it's not just a British phenomenon. And I think one of the central points that we all must get used to is that whatever the British view might be, the European Union is bound to become increasingly diverse and to reflect the inherent differences of view that exist within its member states. Let me explain what I mean by that. Take, for example, the vexed question of a single currency. Even if the United Kingdom, however unlikely this might sound, even if the United Kingdom was to decide tomorrow enthusiastically to be part of a single currency from 1999, however improbable that might be, it would not actually change the fundamental issue that the European Union has to address. Because with or without the United Kingdom, the vast majority of member states of the European Union will not be ready, even if they wish to join a single currency in 1999, and unlikely to be ready even for several years after that. And if the European Union is to expand its membership to include Czechs and Poles and Hungarians, then given the economic conditions in those countries at the present time, we are talking about a generation at the very least before one could contemplate the kind of economic integration that a single currency implies if it was to absorb all the member states of the European Union. And therefore, irrespective of our national debate, the point that I'm making is that on the issue of single currency, and that's only one issue, but it's one of the most important, the European Union is going to have to get used to the fact that either it doesn't happen at all, or if it does happen, it will only involve a relative minority of countries for the foreseeable future, irrespective of the United Kingdom's own decision on matters of this kind. And that is why our Prime Minister was absolutely right to insist that an analysis is needed now of the implications for the European Union of the fact that if a single currency goes ahead for some, there will be the majority, perhaps a very substantial majority, that will not be part of that single currency, and the relationship between those who are and those who are not participating will have profound implications. But single currency is only one part of a wider debate. And the British government's starting position is not skepticism about the European Union as a historic achievement. I am a very strong believer in the benefits that the European Union creates for Europe and for the United Kingdom as part of Europe. Its single most important benefit is, of course, that it has helped cement the links between the peoples of Western Europe in a region of the world that has spawned no less than two world wars in this century alone. And that, after all, was the main motivation of the Founding Fathers. The main motivation was not economic, it was political. And more specifically, it was to prevent war. And that is not just a preoccupation of France and Germany, although that clearly is the most sensitive relationship. The reality is that the breakdown between France and Germany, which led to the First and Second World Wars, also involved many other countries, including the United Kingdom. We lost many millions of people in the First World War and hundreds of thousands in the Second World War, and suffered much of the trauma that others also suffered as a result of that conflict. And so the fact that conflict within Western Europe is now inconceivable is a great historic achievement. So is the single market, because that is actually achieved within Europe a huge opportunity for expanding prosperity and doing so in a quintessentially British way by the breaking down of trading barriers, by a rejection of protectionism. And when you think of how many continental countries, particularly France but also others, have seen protectionism as fundamental to their national interest, the fact that that prejudice has disappeared, that the single market has been largely created, that trade has expanded dramatically, and that Europe has been an example to the world of how you can create an open trading area, is of crucial significance. But although Europe has been a good example in that respect, where it has been a poor example to the rest of the world is in the opportunities it provides for other countries to sell to Europe. We have created a free trading relationship within the European Union, but I have to say there is a depressing degree of protectionism still existing within the European Union as a whole, when it comes to market opportunities for the countries of the Third World and other parts of the world to trade with Europe. And that has to be a major priority and preoccupation for the future. Turning, if I may, to my third comments, and they're all interrelated, Britain's relationship with the wider world and with the Third World in particular. Of course, our relationship in part is historic because of the empire and the Commonwealth which has succeeded it. It's partly influenced by the extent to which English has become, if you will excuse the expression, the lingua franca of the world, and has become the world's first global language. It is partly influenced by other factors as well. And that is, putting aside post-imperial nostalgia, the United Kingdom has a deep self-interest in the in political stability around the world, because political stability and political progress around the world enhances trade, and the United Kingdom, even more than Japan or the United States or other major Western powers, depends on exports and trade for our national prosperity. We export a far higher proportion of what we produce than does the United States or Japan, and it's quite obvious why, because they have huge home markets because of their much larger population, and therefore they do not need to export to the same extent. We have a small home market, and we are, by instinct, a trading power. And therefore, our links with the Third World, the fact that one-third of our diplomatic staff overseas are concerned not with political analysis, but with helping business and exports and trade, is no coincidence. And if we, therefore, are seeking to assist the peace process in the Middle East, if we are anxious to help through our aid program many countries around the world, if we are involved in the Far East and Latin America and elsewhere, it is not only because we accept an ethical obligation, but that is important, it is also because that ethical obligation and our economic objectives can both be served by that global interest and global involvement. And one final point, if I may. The world is desperately short of countries with a mature political base back home in terms of our democratic institutions and with a global outlook. Most countries do not have a global outlook. Most countries are totally concerned with their own regional problems and regional identity. Take China, for example, a vast country of enormous potential, essentially, though, an Asian power with no real interest or involvement in other parts of the world. And that's true of many other countries as well. The United States is an exception to that rule. Britain and France are other exceptions. There aren't many others. And it's quite important as we move towards global economic structures, global environmental problems, global issues that need to be addressed by the international community as a whole. It's quite important that those few countries, which by virtue of their history, their culture, their experience, and their economic interests, do have global perspectives, should participate fully, whether it's in the Security Council of the United Nations, or in the Commonwealth, or in the other global organizations that are developing at the present time. So I conclude these remarks by saying that the United Kingdom, of course, is no longer an empire, and we do not have any sentimental attachment to trying to go back to the past. But we do have both experience, interests, and a contribution to make, quite disproportionate to our size. It happens to be in our own interest to use that experience, and I think for the most part, it is also beneficial in the countries with which we have important links around the globe. Thank you very much.
Can we have some questions to the Foreign Secretary? The gentleman there in the middle.
Well, you may not have noticed it, but we have a private sector economy in the United Kingdom, and we believe that the main role of government is not to invest the taxpayers' taxes directly into industry. That, although called by a different term, was the experience of the socialist societies, which collapsed in poverty and despair. the purpose of government as we see it, I'm sure you're being taught this in the London School of Economics, the purpose of government is to assist industry to do what it can best do without too much government interference. And therefore, what we have seen in the United Kingdom, as well as elsewhere in Western Europe and elsewhere in the world, is certainly a less emphasis on manufacturing, a growth of the service sector. But actually, if you look at the statistics, if I'm not mistaken, manufacturing output is actually greater than it's ever been. What has changed is the percentage of our total economic activity that manufacturing represents. In other words, service sector has grown much faster than manufacturing. But manufacturing, although it's changed, what we manufacture has changed. The actual total output of our manufacturing sector, if I'm not mistaken, has not actually gone down, which is worth reflecting on.
Gentlemen there. Gentlemen there.
Yeah, the question was about the Intergovernmental Conference on the Future of the European Union. We indicated last Thursday that we would be publishing a white paper which would draw together the various statements that have been made and expand on our objective in that respect. Essentially, we do not see, and I don't think many other countries see, the IGC, the Intergovernmental Conference, as a number two Maastricht conference. Maastricht took very fundamental decisions which had quite profound implications for the way the European Union operates. Everyone is still digesting these changes, and it is premature to go through that sort of process again. And therefore, we would see the Intergovernmental Conference as a useful opportunity to look at a number of areas of policy, of where the institutions operate. We have a number of constructive proposals on the European Court of Justice, on the evolution of defence policy, on the role of national parliaments in being consulted on European Union initiatives, a number of areas of that kind. Other countries will have their own ideas, and we will see how quickly agreement is reached. There will be some differences of view as well as some areas of agreement, but that's not unusual.
The gentleman there.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ripken. I put to you the hypothesis that politicians never answer questions directly. Will you answer that?
Depends what your question means.
Yes. Next.
Well, that was an easy one. Is that it? Good, spend it.
Do you think Japan and Germany should get a permanent seat in the UN Security Council? If so, when?
The United Kingdom have said that we do believe that Germany and Japan should be permanent members of the Security Council. It's important to emphasize that membership of the Security Council shouldn't just be, as it were, a reward for economic success. Membership of the Security Council should imply and should require a willingness to be able to contribute towards international security. Now, in the past, Germany and Japan, for historic reasons, have found it difficult to, for example, be involved in peacekeeping operations. Until very recently, neither Germany nor Japan were prepared to allow their armed forces to serve outside their own countries. That has now changed. And Germany, for example, is assisting in Bosnia, had, I think, some German soldiers in Somalia. Japanese also were in Cambodia and elsewhere. So that situation has now changed. But the German and Japanese application to join the Security Council can't be looked at in isolation because you need unanimity to change the charter. And once the question of membership of the Security Council was opened up, a significant number of other countries said, well, we too are interested. India, for example. Brazil has said that if there's to be change, why should she not be involved? So there is a debate going on at the moment, not just about Germany and Japan, but what the new composition of a Security Council should be. We will be flexible on that, but the one caveat I would mention is that what we don't want to see is a Security Council which becomes so large that it is unable to carry out its proper role. It's not meant to be a second General Assembly. It's meant to be a relatively small group of senior countries that can respond quickly to an international crisis and hopefully produce some effective response that brings that crisis to a conclusion. Well, the Rupert Murdoch problem is a separate one. On the BBC World Service as a whole, I think you have been misinformed, and I'm happy to enlighten you. And I'm just about to answer the question. We have seen in recent years the biggest increase in the not only the resources for the World Service, but in the number of languages they broadcast in the history of the World Service. During the last Labour government, the World Service was stagnant, and indeed in the last year, they were cut by 7.5%. During this government, the BBC World Service has had an increase of 50% in its real resources. That's even taking into account inflation. And even in the last 4 years alone, a number of new languages started for the first time. The decision that was announced a few weeks ago, which was badly misrepresented in the press, was a change in their capital funding. And what we have said to the BBC, and they are responding very positively, is that for your capital projects, that's building new relay stations, we want you to use private sector capital to reduce the burden on the taxpayer. And that is indeed the way many capital projects elsewhere are being funded. BBC have said, right, we will look at that positively and see what can be achieved. There will be no cuts in language services. The successful language services are going extremely well. And as this government has presided over the greatest expansion in the BBC and been responsible for its enormous universal success, we would be hardly likely to be so daft as to reverse that process at this particular moment in time.
Gentlemen, there.
Well, as you may know, I was in both Hong Kong and China quite recently. I think the Chinese want to respect Hong Kong's autonomy. They recognize that that is not only important for Hong Kong, but is also crucial to China's own prosperity, because so much investment in China comes from Hong Kong, so much of the exports of China go through Hong Kong, and they also have an even more fundamental, important strategic objective. They would like to persuade Taiwan that if they can demonstrate that Hong Kong's way of life can survive, despite becoming part of China, then why should not Taiwan rejoin the motherland without feeling threatened in the same way? Now, for that to have any chance of succeeding, Hong Kong has got to also succeed. I said that I thought that China wanted to respect Hong Kong's autonomy. The reason why I was slightly guarded in my remarks, and the reason why confidence in Hong Kong at the moment is, I think, there, but it's fragile, is because China is such a different system with such little real day-to-day awareness of what makes Hong Kong special that I think there is always a danger that the Chinese government, however unintentionally, will make speeches or announcements or take decisions which will severely damage confidence in Hong Kong, even if that was not intended. There is, for example, a controversy about the future of the elected Legislative Council in Hong Kong set up by Chris Patten under the reforms he introduced a few years ago. There is a proposal that the Chinese are considering to weaken the Bill of Rights Ordinance. There are a number of changes of that kind, which, if not handled very sensitively, could severely damage confidence in Hong Kong, and that would be very much against China's interests as well as Hong Kong. So I don't think there will be any deliberate desire to destroy Hong Kong's way of life, but it could happen by accident, and that is what we all have to guard against.
Next. The gentleman in the corner. Yes.
Well, we have a particular interest in Cyprus, not only because we were once the colonial power, but also there are the two sovereign base areas still on Cyprus, and we are a guarantor, along with Greece and Turkey, of the Cyprus constitution. Now, Cyprus has been divided for 27 years. And I think it is indeed depressing and deplorable that at a time when in South Africa the problem of apartheid has been overcome peacefully, at a time when in the Middle East huge progress is being made of reconciliation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and when other global problems are being addressed, Cyprus goes on as a divided state and without any discernible signs of progress. So I think it's going to be highly desirable for the international community, including the United Kingdom, to do what we can to impress upon both Turks and Greeks the need for dialogue. They're not even talking to each other at the moment. And so the first objective is to get dialogue going again, and then through that dialogue to actually create a structure that leads to the withdrawal of Turkish troops from northern Cyprus, the reunification of the island. And of course, Cyprus has applied to join the European Union, and it'll be very difficult, if not impossible, for a divided Cyprus to contemplate full membership of the European Union. So we're in a changed situation.
Well, there you go.
Well, I think that the instability of Europe is, in one sense, self-evident, that it is ironic that during the years of the Cold War, although there was always a threat of a general war breaking out, there was never, for about 40 years, there was never any actual conflicts on the continent of Europe. There were no wars. Nobody died through military conflict on any of the fault lines between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And yet with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, we now have had hot wars, most obviously in Bosnia, but also in Moldova, in Armenia, in Azerbaijan, and a number of other sensitive places. So it's a very unstable Eastern Europe. And the threats to security come essentially from three sources. First of all, we do not know what the future of Russia will be. She remains a massive nuclear power. Who knows what will happen in the Russian presidential election? Churchill was once asked to predict the future of Russia. He said, "I cannot predict the future of Russia. She is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma." And that's true today as it was 50 years ago. So that's one potential source of instability and uncertainty. The second are the nationalist conflicts on various borders within particularly Central and Eastern Europe, the most obvious being the Bosnian war. The third is the potential danger around Europe's shores. North Africa is a very unstable region at the moment. Libya already has missiles which could reach parts of southern Europe. Other countries are developing capabilities of that kind. So there are potential threats of instability in the Mediterranean region, which also have direct relevance to our own security.
Gentlemen there, keep your question short.
My question is that it refers to the state of this country's relations with Saudi Arabia. I was wondering if you get the impression from the popular press that in the Saudi regime that in a sense leads the British Foreign Department and also the Home Office in terms of the family policy. The man who's responsible largely for this is coming here tomorrow to address the Dr. Mohammed al-Nassari. And I note that in the press, the Saudi regime...
Could you keep it short? Could you keep it short? Ask the question.
My question simply is this. Now that your government has decided to expel him, that this will resolve the relations, the cooperation between this country and Saudi Arabia.
Well, Mr. Mazari was an illegal immigrant, and normally illegal immigrants are deported. That's what's happened for very many years under successive Home Secretaries and successive governments. What made the Mazari case more difficult for the Home Office was if he was simply deported back to the country from which he came, he might have been liable to persecution because of his political activities. That is... Well, wait a moment. Wait a moment. Mr. Mazari, however, is also involved in very many activities. There is another country willing to take him where he would not be suffering persecution. There is no reason why we should give a home to illegal immigrants when there are other countries that are prepared to take them. And that is the conclusion the Home Secretary reached.
Okay, next.
So now, next. Now you know.
Keep it a short question, please.
You mentioned the United Kingdom's global economic and environmental outlook, but there is a very, very great concern in developing countries that the industrialized countries are creating environmental hazards, but not doing enough to solve environmental problems. Could you kindly give a recent example in which the United Kingdom would have contributed politically and financially to solve the global environmental problems of the world?
Well, we participate. You can't solve the problems by one country alone. We are participating in virtually all the global initiatives to reduce environmental pollution. And whether it's the ozone layer, or whether it's the use of carbons, or whether it's in other areas, the United Kingdom is a very full player in that. And we took a very full part of the Rio conference, for example, and will continue to play a very major part.
Gentleman there, who's been waiting for a long time.
Well, I think the question of NATO enlargement will be to be decided by NATO and by any applicant country. No third country, including Russia, can have a veto on whether NATO chooses to accept new members or not. And I believe that there is clear interest from a number of countries in wishing to join. I think that there is a lot of work that has already been done in considering the implications of enlargement. And at some stage, probably towards the end of this year, we will have to consider when the formal negotiations with individual countries should begin. And I think that process is likely to go ahead.
One last question, lady here.
The linking of social clauses to trade. Well, I think one would need to see whether what was the desired purpose of such a linkage. The history of using trade in order to impose social or political objectives is not very encouraging. There have been some examples where it's worked, but for the most part it ends in tears. So I think one would be reluctant to go down that route unless there was very clear evidence that pressure of a particular kind would produce good results in a finite period of time.
Can I, on your behalf, thank the Foreign Secretary very much for a very full address. And I hope he comes again.